Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 207 of Geeked Out Radio. I'm back this week with Bex.
Hello, I do quite like that intro.
Yes, yeah, I thought you would.
That's it. I was expecting more crashing noises or explosions.
No, well, you've not managed to damage yourself. I was going to try and clip a little bit from Big in Japan, the song, but I decided against that and I thought I'd just go with the Sega one instead. So, been a while since you've been on because you've not been here. You've been away. Tell the people where you've been.
I have been in Tokyo for 5 weeks because I decided completely on a whim to take me and my laptop and film gear and bought some ridiculously cheap last minute flights and then sofa surfed for 5 weeks because that seemed like a good thing to do for my birthday, having not been able to go abroad for such a long time.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, don't do things by halves.
No.
It was a very, very good adventure.
Good. Yes, you've been posting stuff on Twitter and Facebook and various other places. So it looks like you've been having fun out there. Anything in particular?
Oh, goodness. So much. And there's so much that was not posted on social media. The backlog of spam of my adventures in Japan is absolutely epic. Plus all the videos I need to finish editing as well. I've only got one video up so far, so there's quite a few more of those to come as well.
Cool.
Highlights. For me, the biggest thing was going to the Studio Ghibli Museum.
Yes.
For those who know directors like Hayao Miyazaki and animes like, you know, Your Spirited Ways and Castle in the Sky and Howl's Moving Castle and so forth. It's the museum for those creators. And I've waited 10 years to go there because the last time I was in Japan, it was during a period of refurbishment, so it was closed.
Oh, no.
It was incredible and quite emotional for me as well. So that was awesome. You walk through a park to get to the museum, which they've custom built. So it looks like it's from one of these beautiful animated fantasy movies. It's a very unusual building, completely custom designed by Hayao Miyazaki when he decided he wanted to share the history of the studio and all of their movies. So he designed it all from scratch.
That's amazing.
I bought a book of watercolors of the paintings he did to show the designers that built the museum as well. Which is pretty awesome that they went to that level to create something so beautiful. As you come around the corner through the park, though, you can see on the roof, which I didn't realize you could see from outside, a beautiful spiral staircase that goes up with ivy around it. And right at the top of the building on a roof garden is a life-size statue of one of the robots from a film called Laputa Castle in the Sky, which is probably the most important movie I've ever seen in my life. Watched it since I was a child and inspired me to get into art and film and everything, basically. And you can see this giant robot replica from the outside. So as I walked around the corner, I swore very, very loudly. And obviously, being a museum that's got a lot of animated movies, some of which are aimed at adults and about children surviving in war periods. Other ones, however, are like Totoro and things, which are children's movies. So there's a lot of children in the queue. And in any country, in any language, some words are kind of widely understood.
Yes.
So I did some apologizing. I spent 4 hours looking around the museum. It was full of, like, one room was a recreation of several of the artist's studios. It was full of their watercolors, acrylic and oil paintings, sketchbooks, books of collected references, so I could look through and see the reference photos they took to help them design the environments for the movies or the animals in the movies, and just entire walls with the actual watercolors and pages from hand-painted screenplays.
Wow.
Just pinned all over the walls. After 4 hours, I was still seeing new things, new details, and that was utterly incredible when you just spot something pinned to a corner around a wall with some other stuff around it, and you'd be like, hang on a minute, that's the original sketch for the castle in this, or that's an early version of this character design.
Yeah.
You know, that's some drawings of some engines, so they definitely would get the plane engines correct in this movie. That just absolutely amazing to see. Yeah, so that made me quite emotional, and I was still spotting more things after 4 hours. Even tiny parts of the museum, like the grills on little grates in the outside area, which they'd put the tools to keep the garden taken care of, you know, tiny little things like this, still had a Totoro worked into the ironwork. that's kind of what you're getting with this museum.
Yes.
Everything
detail
is made of love. Another thing that's quite awesome about being there is they have all these short movies, 15-minute animated movies, which you were only able to see inside the museum.
Oh, wow.
And they're on rotation, so each month or so they swap which one is being shown in their little theatre, which is surrounded by stained glass of characters from their shows as well, these big stained glass things everywhere. And you can watch an exclusive 15-minute movie.
Wow.
Which was quite lovely to see as well. So, yeah, definitely that was up there on amazing experiences, and not just if you're massively into anime or massively into this studio, just seeing the process of how they make the movie or the cell animation, the watercolor paintings, I think that would be a wonderful experience for anyone. They have a giant cat bus for anyone that's seen Totoro, a wonderful family film. It has a life-size cat who is also a bus with
of course
12 legs. I swear it makes sense in context. and they have a giant, like, one-to-one scale plushy cat bus.
Right.
Surrounded by cushions for children to play in as one of the rooms. Obviously, there's signs everywhere saying this is for children only. Do not. No adults are allowed in the cat bus. And a lot of adults sulking by the side. And because there's no filming or photos allowed to be taken within the museum, you just are immersed in that world. And I can see why people think that's a tough call, but I think it's the right call for that kind of museum. You are allowed to film outside and on the roof, though, so I do have footage to show, and obviously the watercolors I can show from the book I bought about how the museum got made. So that made me quite emotional and was pretty damn awesome. Definitely
wow.
a must do for anyone that goes to Japan. You have to book your tickets like months in advance as well, usually, with that one.
Right.
I was lucky because I was obviously staying with people who lived there that could access local tickets and go through
right.
lottery processes in the local convenience stores to get Japanese-based tickets.
Right.
But normally, much more planning is required than I generally do.
yes.
What else was awesome? There's a giant it's cool if you like giant robots at all. There is an anime series called Gundam, which has been around since 1979 and is still going, and it includes ginormous transforming huge robots so big the pilot just goes in the head. I think like giant Transformers, but they're not alive, they are machines in this case, and they have a one-to-one scale replica Gundam.
I think I saw the photo you posted of this. It's amazing.
I've taken a lot of video of it as well. It's one-to-one scale ginormous robot. I miss the original 1979 robot. This one is the 2010 Gundam Unicorn, which, controversial to anime fans, I kind of prefer that design. It just absolutely incredible, stupidly detailed. And at night there's a show and the thing changes color, LEDs, and there's a lights projected on it. They project the anime behind it, and in time to that, small parts of it move, the head opens, there's sound effects.
Oh wow.
And I just sat there with my mouth open just going, this is amazing. I went and saw that three times.
Justifiable, I think.
Yeah. Absolutely incredible. So that's probably the two geekiest highlights from the Japan trip. Yeah, it was just 5 weeks of adventure, making friends, seeing what it's like to live in Tokyo. Nearly got eaten by an eagle as well.
Okay.
I say nearly got eaten. If it had seen me, I probably would have got eaten. I was in a remote, a small island connected to the mainland,
right,
sort of about 40 minutes from the south of Tokyo. And it's like a big hill. It's got some caves by the sea. It's got also a lot of birds of prey, primarily very large kites, which in a much more badass way than in the UK, steal your food when you're on the beach.
Right.
Imagine them walking up. We think seagulls are bad enough, right?
Imagine them walking up to you and going, give us that ice cream.
Yeah, well, they're known for swooping down, and they're up to kind of like good, easily over a meter, these kites.
Jeez.
And they will swoop down and steal your food. There's signs for that. And I'd gone out past where there was a temple and out into an area of greenery where you're allowed to have picnics, to have a little picnic. And I was there at an unusual time of day and there was no one else there. And just eating a little, it was jelly with fruit in, like you get in school.
Yeah.
Awesome. They have those in all the corner shops, these little things of jelly with fruit in. I was very happy. eating one of those, and sort of like with, you know, the bit of jelly on the spoon lifted up to the mouth, sort of almost Jurassic Park style-y, you know.
Yeah.
And everything moves because this huge eagle, I mean, I wouldn't have been surprised if it was just over 2 meters. It was enormous. I tried to kind of downplay it a bit because I didn't want to sound like I was exaggerating, but it's one of the largest birds of prey I've ever seen.
Yes.
And I've done a little bit of falconry. And it swooped through a tree, everything was crashing, it then did this crazy U-turn and went out over the sea,
right?
And I'm just there, you know, with the spoon, but the jelly's fallen off by this point. Just thinking, my goodness, the claws on that thing were significantly bigger than my hands.
Wow.
And I'm not sure I would have fed so well if it just seen me.
Thankfully it didn't fancy jelly that day, so
if I'd had a hot dog,
yes, it would have been very different.
Might have gone quite differently. So yeah, that's three things that happened which I shan't forget in any short amount of time. It's a pretty awesome place, and I did a fair amount of filming of different things, which I will share with everyone once they're up on the YouTubes.
Yes.
Yes. Cool. Have you ever been out to Japan?
I haven't. No, I was very tempted because not only have you been out there, Ross was out there at the same time, our other fellow co-host. So apparently flights and hotels were fairly cheap the few weeks out in Japan, so I was very tempted to go out, and but I ended up opting to go to LA instead for a week, so I did that. But yes, I was.
That's not a bad call either. I've never been to LA.
Oh, it's such good fun. I had a great fun. So yeah, I was out in LA for a week, and I did a few things while I was out there. I did a couple of studio tours. So I did the VIP tour at Universal, which is always good fun. I've done that once before, where you basically get a tour guide and they do an extended tour around the back lots. Because Universal, you're usually stuck in the trams because it's a huge lot. It's basically the largest film studio in Hollywood. So you're usually stuck on the trams the entire time. And it's great, the normal tour, but on the extended tour, they actually let you out of the trams to go wandering around, which is really nice. And you get to go into the prop room and stuff. So I did that. I went
around.
What
was the best prop? What was the best? What did you want to steal while you were there?
They had a life-size ET, which was quite cool. Which I have a photo of me stood next to the ET. And so that I would have quite liked to steal. That was quite good. Had fun there. Warner Brothers, I went and did their normal tour as well. And I like the Warner Brothers studio. I mean, it's certainly, if you're a fan of shows of like the Gilmore Girls, Pretty Little Liars as well, because Gilmore Girls and Pretty Little Liars is basically shot in exactly the same place. But if you're a fan of the Gilmore Girls, it's Stars Hollow, the central area of that is the Stars Hollow set, essentially. And a lot of it is built around that. So that's really quite good fun. The DC shows, although the CW DC shows don't actually shoot in LA, they all shoot in Vancouver. But what they did have was a lot of the costumes. They had like the Flash costume and the Supergirl costume and the Arrow costume were all there. They'd also got a lot of stuff from the movies. So they had a huge Aquaman thing going on. So they had all the costumes from Aquaman, and they've got a lot of Harry Potter stuff there as well. And of course, Universal has, because they don't do theme park stuff at the Warner Brothers Studios, Universal has the Hogsmeade Harry Potter thing as well, where it is, which they basically built the whole of Hogsmeade outside, you know, and a massive Hogwarts as well, which they've built there. So that's all, and that's got a ride inside it. That's all really good fun. So got to do all that. The other thing was Cobra Kai, you know, the Karate Kid YouTube show. Mm-hmm. They were doing a live concert at the Whiskey A Go Go, which for those of you who don't know, is a very, very famous LA nightclub. They were doing a concert with the composers, Leo Birnberg and Zach Robinson were doing a sort of live thing for the music for Cobra Kai. And it's all very kind of 80s style synth music, which is really good fun. And they got Myron and Droid Bishop were two of the other bands that were playing on there as well. They were fabulous. And I went along for that on the one night. They also introduced Joe Esposito, who sang You're the Best from the original Karate Kid movie. Joe Esposito is 71 years old and still has the same voice that he had back in 1984 when they released that single. He was absolutely phenomenal. So yeah, hats off to him. He was brilliant. So they brought him out on stage. They brought some of the cast out as well. So got to see some of the cast. So that was really good fun. I really enjoyed that. Other things I've done since I've coming back, New Amsterdam, the medical drama that's on Amazon. I went and interviewed some of the cast for that. That will be going up on the website soon. That was Ryan Eggold, Freema Agyeman, and Janet Montgomery from New Amsterdam. So I did an interview with those guys. The audio may go onto the podcast. I need to check whether I'm cleared to actually use the audio or not, but it will go up as a written interview if I'm not allowed to use the audio. So we'll see on that. But they were fabulous. Ryan Eggold is hilariously funny and really, really entertaining. And him and Freema together particularly are very, very funny. So I love that show. It's a fantastic medical drama. And the whole first season of that's on Amazon Prime if you want to go and watch that. And then he's just been catching up with other things that have been on TV, really, the last few weeks. Chernobyl, which obviously now kind of run out, but one of the best pieces of TV I've seen in a very, very long time. And he's probably going to win all the awards this year, I rather suspect, because it was absolutely
I've heard
brilliant.
So many people raving about it, including a lot of people who wouldn't normally watch a show with that kind of format or premise.
Yeah. Really well worth watching. It's truly a phenomenal show. So I was watching that. Designated Survivor Season 3, that has returned. And it's interesting. This is the first one done by Netflix. So it's a bit more sweary than previous versions. It's gone a bit West Wing, which is no bad thing, I don't think. West Wing's a great show, so it's not necessarily something that you should particularly be ashamed of aping. But there's a lot more kind of walking and talking, and they're focusing a bit more on the politics rather than the conspiracy theory stuff that was there before. So it's only 10 episodes, not the full 22, which it was previously because it's now a Netflix show, but still thoroughly enjoyable. Really, really good. Handmaid's Tale back for a third season, and that's as good as it ever was.
Yeah, I've not watched that yet, so no spoilers. I need to catch up on it.
Yeah, and I've got a whole bunch of stuff that I need to catch up on. Killing Eve, I did watch the first episode of the new series, but I need to watch the rest of it. But that's again fabulous. There's the ITV show Wild Bill I need to catch up on. Absentia season 2 of that's now out. I need to go watch that. Jessica Jones, I haven't started yet the third season of that. I did watch Catch 22, which is the new Channel 4 series. Hilariously funny. It's very kind of Coen Brothers in the format. It's done by George Clooney, and you know George Clooney has a long relationship with the Coen Brothers, and it is a George Clooney production, but it feels kind of like a Coen Brothers thing. And the whole Catch 22 thing, I mean, you know the phrase Catch 22, and this is basically sort of where it came from. And the idea that it's set in, I think it's the Second World War, and it's set around this bomber crew, and the Catch 22 in this situation is he's a guy that's sick of the war, trying to get out of it. He's talking to the doctor, and the doctor is basically explaining, well, yes, you've got to be crazy to be prepared to fight in this war and want to fly missions, but the problem is the only way you can get out of flying missions is if you go to the doctor to say, this is insane, I want I want to get out of it. But by going to ask him that you want to get out of flying missions, you're then proving that you are in actual fact sane, because that's the sign of a sane mind. Therefore, you've got to go and fly the missions. So
is this effectively another adaptation of the book?
Yes, it is.
It's not connected to the first movie, which was out in the 70s, I want to say.
Yeah, no, it is another adaptation of the book. It's a miniseries. It's an adaptation of the book. It's got a great cast. Clooney's in it at the start. Hugh Laurie in it as well. It's really, really good. And I've only seen the first episode of that, but really enjoyed it. So well worth going to watch. That's on Channel 4. There's a couple of other little bits of news that snuck out whilst we've been off, because we had a bit of a hiatus last week because I was on a plane at the time and was kind of feeling slightly too tired to do any editing by the time I got back. So
you mean you can't be on a plane, use Skype, edit and broadcast all at the same time?
No, not on a transatlantic flight, you can't.
Well, that's entirely reasonable.
And you kind of, when you're flying back from the US, you basically lose 10 hours. So I was kind of getting kicked around by jet lag by the time I got back. And I was like, I just can't face editing something. So yes, apologies for no show last week. But there was a couple of bits of news that popped out whilst we've been kind of off the last couple of weeks. Have you seen that photo of Mackenzie Crook from the Wurzel Gummidge adaptation?
The what with the what now?
Wurzel Gummidge.
I know I've been in another country for a while, but yes, that's a thing.
You're aware of Wurzel Gummidge? There are a couple of things this week which are designed to destroy your childhood. The first one was there is a Wurzel Gummidge adaptation coming from Mackenzie Crook. It's basically two films which are based on the Wurzel Gummidge books, so which is obviously what the original TV series that we all know and love that starred John Pertwee in it. There are two films coming out based on those original books as well, with Mackenzie Crook in the lead role. There have been a lot of discussion about the makeup for Wurzel in that, because it's not the best, I have to say. I'm not overly convinced by the makeup in it. I think they've tried to make him look like a Swede, I guess. Some sort of root vegetable.
Like just having, now looking at the picture you have just sent me, and I'm pulling a slightly quizzical face.
Yes, it doesn't have the sort of sweet cuteness that they did of the original TV show. But again, this is an adaptation of the books, not a remake of the TV show, although that is where most people will know it from. And I think actually they've overdone the makeup. It probably would have been better not to have quite layered it on so thick.
It's going to be hard to, I mean, I'm just making a guess, but emoting through that, because Wurzel's a character that you're supposed to empathize with quite a lot. And I'm wondering how much movement and how much individual muscle control you can get through that level of makeup. I mean, until I see it move, I won't know. But looking at it from there, it looks quite static.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. I want to see a trailer for it to see how well it works. But there was a very mixed reaction, and a lot of it not very positive to that idea. So we'll see. It is going to be two 60-minute films, basically, they're making of it, based on a couple of the books. No news on when they're actually releasing it yet. It'll be on the BBC. It's got Christmas written all over it, pretty much, I think.
Yeah, I would agree with you there.
This is going to be their Christmas thing. But they haven't actually said that officially, but that seems to me where it's going to be. The other thing which is set to ruin your childhood, there is a trailer for a new Banana Splits movie. It's made by Sci-Fi, and it's the Banana Splits as a horror movie. So, yes.
I think I speak for any of you people currently listening right now who weren't aware of that when I just say, eh?
Yeah, for those of you that are too young to know the Banana Splits, Banana Splits Adventure Hour was a variety show, had people in large furry costumes, essentially. Fleagle the Beagle, Drooper the Lion, Snorky the Elephant, and Bingo the Gorilla were the four main characters. And it was this sort of mix of live action and animation. These sort of anthropomorphic furries played this bubblegum rock band, and they sort of linked the animated stuff together, and it had cartoons in it and all that sort of stuff, but they were kind of live action. It ran from the late 60s to the early 70s, although most people in the UK probably remember it from Saturday morning reruns in the 70s and 80s, those of you who remember it. Sci-Fi, the US network, have created a movie based on the Banana Splits, but the idea is that it is a horror film, and they are essentially, there's a kid that goes to a recording of it. There is an evil executive that tries to cancel the show, and the four Banana Splits characters seem to fight back, and that involves killing people. It's the weirdest trailer you will ever see. If you particularly,
this just,
if you know,
screams like an indie comic that someone made and then got sent a cease and desist order.
Yes,
the idea that this is being made by Sci-Fi is both awesome and just so, yeah, I am so incredibly surprised you are allowed to do that.
Yeah,
license, and it kind of sounds like it could be amazing.
Yes,
but usually when you get this kind of darkness, it's either a fan made thing and they get sent letters saying, "Could you not?"
Yeah,
or it's something like Happy, which is purpose written, where they take that cuteness and make something super dark out of it.
Yeah.
So to use pre-existing characters that people are likely to remember and then do that twist with it on a channel like Sci-Fi, I'm now going to have to watch this.
Yes. We don't know when it or if it's going to air on Sci-Fi in the UK, although I guess it probably will. It sounds like the type of thing that they will probably put out globally, but we'll have to wait and see. We don't know that for a fact. I mean, it seems very much in the sort of Sharknado-y type mold, but it is weird that they've been allowed to use the license in this way. Yeah, we'll just have to wait and see, but there is a trailer for that up on the website. If you remember the Banana Splits and want to go look at it, it is bizarre, to say the least. It is very, very strange. So that was some of the weirder things that popped out while we were off air. With that in mind, let's move on to some TV and film news.
Give me some time to recover after that strange announcement.
Yes. So TV and film news, we'll start off with the renewals, cancellations and pickups. There obviously are quite a lot because we've kind of been off for a couple of weeks. So first thing is, it looks like Channel 5, not unsurprisingly, of Dixed Will and Grace, which is the very Channel 5 thing to do. They sort of buy things for one season and then don't run it again. NBC Universal, who own the series, it looks like they're looking to release DVDs over the summer of the whatever it is, season 14 or 10 or 11 or I don't know, whatever it is at this point. But the next season, it looks like going to get a DVD release rather than a main TV release, which is weird because Universal do have a channel in the UK. I know they're separate entities, but you kind of would have thought that maybe shoving it onto that would be the most sensible thing, but apparently not. They're talking about DVD releases. So
unless they'd given the option to Channel 5 and it's still under...
Maybe. It may be a licensing thing. I don't know. But I wish Channel 5 wouldn't do that. I wish they wouldn't buy things like that, because it's not the sort of thing that seems to run very well on Channel 5. And they should know that by now. So weirdly, they are buying some reasonable kind of, you know, things like Canadian dramas and stuff, but they're shoving them out on the MyFive streaming channel rather than putting them on Channel 5, which is weird. Netflix have cancelled the horror series Chambers, which starred Uma Thurman. That's been canned after one season. Didn't see it, so I have no idea whether it's any good or not, but there's that. Yellowstone, the drama fronted by Kevin Costner, that is being renewed for third season. It has added Joss Holloway for the third season as well, who is your man from Lost, played Sawyer in Lost and was in Colony as well. Now, one that's going to hurt Bex, Deadly Class cancelled by Sci-Fi. Cancelled by Sci-Fi, at which point I think should be the channel's motto. So that's been cancelled by Sci-Fi after one season. It is coming to Stars Play, the Amazon channel. They are going to air that from July the 19th, if you want to go and watch that. They've also cancelled Happy after two seasons as well. There is a second season of Happy, which is on Netflix.
Where's the petition for that?
Yeah, the second season of that is now up on Netflix, but that is it. They're not making any more of it, which is frustrating, but again,
it is quite a niche thing being as dark as it is. Having just had the conversation that they're basically making something like the Banana Splits over on Sci-Fi that's pretty dark and so forth, Happy again, it is quite niche, and there's only so many people like me that want to watch something like that, but I am still sad that it didn't get a third season.
Yes, it's me too, because I haven't watched the second season yet, but I really love the first season. So yes, sorry to see that go. but they've cancelled both those. So that's Deadly Class and Happy both gone. The Good Place has also not been cancelled. It's a production decision. They are ending it with season four, which I will be very, very sad to see go. But I get why they're ending it, because I think it's one of those things that really shouldn't have had a life after the first season, because the first season was very much such a self-contained thing. And then they ran it for another season and managed to alter it in such a brilliant way. And then another season where they twisted it again. And I think there's only so many times you can get away with doing that and still make it work. So I adore that show. It's superb and brilliantly written. But full season of The Good Place, which is the upcoming season, will be its last one. Production decision, creative decision, not cancelled, just ending. So it will wrap up properly, that. Weird one as well, Swamp Thing, the DC Universe show, has been cancelled after one season, although the entire season hasn't gone out yet. Like two or three episodes have gone out, but they cancelled it after one episode had gone out. And it was very critically acclaimed, that episode, but they still decided they were going to ditch it. So there's been numerous reasons why they're saying that it's being dropped. Some people, it appears to be a financial decision more than anything else. There are changes going on at Warner Brothers in terms of management, and I think they were struggling with the amount of money that was being spent on Swamp Thing. They apparently built an undercover swamp set, which cost quite a lot of money to build and was going to cost a fortune to house and store if they were coming back for another season. So that appears to be another reason. So it was just an expensive show to make. That appears to be one of the reasons. But weirdly, I mean, the critical reaction to it after the first episode was brilliant. So it seems like a very, very odd decision, but apparently the decision has already been made that he's not returning.
Well, hopefully the end of the series has a good conclusion rather than a cliffhanger, they can do something to wrap it up if it's going to garner such critical acclaim. It would be a shame if it just has an abrupt stop, but I guess we won't know till it's all out.
No, we won't. And I don't hold out much hope for that, because it was supposed to be 10 episodes and they trimmed it to 8, I think. So, you know, and that was earlier on in the, you know, quite early on they announced that they trimmed a couple of episodes off it. So I don't have a great amount of hope that it's going to wrap up particularly well either, but we'll have to wait and see. No UK date for it anywhere yet. Same with Doom Patrol. We've not seen any signs of either of those coming across. So we'll have to wait and see if they turn up over here. Netflix has put in some renewals, though. They've renewed Russian Doll, which is the wonderful mind-bending comedy series, which is sort of a Groundhog Day-esque thing about a girl that's stuck in a party. They've renewed that for a second season, which I'm very happy about, because that was a really, really good first season. I think it was only like 6 episodes, 8 episodes maybe, and they're only half an hour long, so it wasn't very long. But really, really fun first season, so I'm glad they're bringing that back. They've also renewed Lucifer for a fifth and final season, and I thought they did a really good job with the full season. Only 10 episodes, but they put it to a place which could have wrapped it up if they weren't going to come back. So I wasn't sure whether they were going to bring it back, but I am glad they're going to bring it back for a fifth season, and we'll see where they go with that. But you know, it's great. They seem very happy that it's been brought back. The cast seem very happy. So that's all good. A couple of smaller stories as well. You've got ITV have renewed Cold Feet for a 9th season. That's coming back. Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon's The Trip is returning for a 4th season, and they're going to Greece for that. But that's moving from Sky Atlantic to Sky One when that returns. I think that's going to be next year. And NBC are developing Langdon, which is a prequel series based on the Da Vinci Code novel The Lost Symbol. So having done it in the movies, they're now doing a prequel series on TV. Weirdly, The Lost Symbol is actually a book that's set after all the other Da Vinci Code books, but they've tweaked it to make it a prequel instead, just to confuse fans. I think that's the purpose of that. But it depends whether you like the Da Vinci Code things. There were a lot of people commenting there are much better books out there that you could make TV series out of, and I quite agree there are, but it's a known brand, so NBC are going with it. Don't know whether that will go to full series, but they are developing it at the moment. Moving on to bigger news, and this was one I thought Bex would be particularly interested in. The team behind Krypton are apparently developing a standalone Lobo series.
Yes, I'm very interested to see how that will go, because obviously Lobo is a character I have a particular affinity for. And not getting to see Simon Bisley at MCM by virtue of being in Tokyo, who worked on Lobo, was one of the things that made me sort of go, am I in the right place when I was in Tokyo? So yeah, a Lobo series would be awesome. The question is, will they pull their punches with it? Because it's quite a violent comic book.
It is. I mean, they've just introduced Lobo on the second season of Krypton. MHJ Scanlan is portraying Lobo. And interesting. I mean, he's possibly not quite as big as you want him to be, but I think overall the look seems all right. There are photos floating around of it. And I think he has actually appeared in the US now. It's season two hasn't gone out in the UK yet, but
I've seen the stills from the episodes floating around on the internet, and he looks pretty good as a Lobo. To get someone to be Lobo to look as big as Lobo does, it'd be quite difficult for casting, since one of the things about his character design was that he was a satire of the super gritty, edgy 1990s comics. So he in himself is supposed to be, well, he was introduced sort of as a parody, but everyone loved him so much he became an actual character. So there's going to be a certain amount of adjustment they have to do, because the whole point is that he's ridiculous. And if he turned up in Krypton as muscly as he is in the comics, he would have looked like a comedy monster.
Yes, it sort of makes sense. And it sounds like they've kept a lot of the personality stuff in there. I mean, for those of you that don't know Lobo, he's basically a character, the sort of superhuman speed, strength, stamina. The unique thing about him really is the fact that he's basically unkillable, because he can regenerate his entire self from a single drop of blood. He's also incredibly intelligent, although does come across as a sort of 90s, 80s biker look.
Ripped sort of clothes on a motorbike, Kiss style heavy metal makeup, long dreadlocks, and a killer bulldog called Dog, spelled with a W.
So, yeah, I mean, I really do like this character. They use him in the 52 run, not the new 52 comic book run, but the actual comic book called 52. They use him quite a lot in that, and he's fabulous in that run. And, he's a great character. So I am looking forward to seeing what that actually comes up like. It will be the same guy, so it will be a direct spin-off. It's the same people behind it. We'll have to wait and see exactly what happens with that and whether it actually moves forward. But I do rather like the look of that. I really can't believe they're making a Lobo TV series. That's crazy. And I mean, it's on Sci-Fi in the US, so that's a cable channel, and it's the same people it's the same channel that did things like Happy. So you can make it quite violent. You can do things that are out there on that channel. So hopefully it will do that. We'll just have to wait and see. Moving on, we've got Sky and HBO have teamed up for a new series called The Third Day, which is a limited series starring Jude Law. This is another team up between Sky and HBO. I think we're going to see a bit more of this, because everything went so well with Chernobyl that I think, you know, they have teamed up a couple of times before, but I think we're going to see more of it. So The Third Day stars Jude Law as Sam, who, after being drawn to a mysterious island off the British coast, is thrown into an unusual world of its secretive inhabitants. Isolated from the mainland, the ritual of the islands begin to overwhelm him, and he's confronted by trauma from his past. As the line between reality and fantasy blurs, Sam finds himself immersed in an emotional quest which puts him at odds with the islands and begins to threaten their way of life. So it's sounding a little bit Wicker Man, in all honesty. Who knows? But I don't know. Jude Law, I think, you know, great actor, good, solid team behind it. It comes from Dennis Kelly, who was the writer behind Utopia and Pulling. And I mean, given the sort of weird premise of it, Utopia seems like an interesting touch point for it. Yeah, I kind of will live or die on whether you like Jude Law, I guess. And last story we've got, Marvel's Runaways have added a new cast member as Morgan Le Fay. And it's Elizabeth Hurley, interestingly, is playing Morgan Le Fay on Runaways for the next season. Do you know Morgan Le Fay particularly as a Marvel character?
Yes, I used to read Namor back in the day.
Ah, there you go.
And she was involved in that because, she is a sorceress and she's connected to Merlin. So she's a really old character. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, she's actually older than Marvel itself. I mean, she is technically a Marvel character, but she actually first appeared in 1955 in Atlas Comics, which was the precursor to Marvel Comics. So she's been around in a very, very long time. It was 1978 where they kind of reintroduced her into the Marvel Universe as a villain for Spider-Woman, apparently. But she has gone up against the Avengers, Doctor Strange, Spider-Man, Hawkeye, pretty much every Marvel hero at some point.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen her in anything recently, certainly not in any of the big main titles. So that's quite an interesting choice, and it gives them quite a reasonable amount of free rein to do something that makes it their own as well.
Yeah, and Runaways has been a good series. I mean, you know, they've been doing a decent job with it, I think. It's been really good fun. I'm not a huge Elizabeth Hurley fan particularly, but this sort of scenery chewing kind of villain is the sort of thing I think she does quite well. So I think this could be quite interesting. We'll have to wait and see. Should turn up next season, so we'll see how that goes. But Runaways, first two seasons have aired on Sci-Fi in the UK, so presumably the third season will air next year at some point. So that's all the news we have for this week. Next up, we have the interview.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The interview this week is with the Emmy-nominated composer Dominic Scherer. Basically, if you've watched any high-quality BBC drama in the past few years, the chances are you have heard his music at some point. He is the composer behind shows such as Baptiste, The City in the City, The Widow, The Missing, Ripper Street. He recently won an Ivor Novello Award for his work on Requiem. He's previously worked on Agatha Christie's Marple, Monroe, Inspector George Gently. He also worked on Primeval as well. So we do chat a little bit about that. I was speaking to him at his studio in London. He's a Swiss composer, but he's based pretty much full-time in London. He's his main kind of hub. So here's the interview with Dominic. We'll see you afterwards with some highlights for next week on TV. It's lovely to have you on and to chat a bit about your work. It is rare that I talk to somebody who's actually in the same country because they're always somewhere up in the mountains in LA.
Yeah,
so it's really nice to have you on to chat. And when we booked this interview, as you were saying before, you were Ivor Novello nominated. You're now Ivor Novello winning for this. It's the second one you've got, actually, this, isn't it? Because you got
it's amazing.
So how is the event? How is winning for which one was it you won for
Requiem?
For Requiem,
Netflix and BBC series Requiem. And for that one, I was working with Natasha Khan, also known as Bat for Lashes. So we won it together for that, and it did come as a surprise, a bit, you know, because also, you know, our sort of competitor co-nominee was, you know, Clint Mansell, who I'm of course a big fan of, and you know, so it did come as a surprise when they called out our name.
Nice surprise, though. Yeah, definitely.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So, what do they give you for the Ivor Novello?
It's really beautiful. I think out of all the awards, it's probably the nicest one to get because it's a beautiful bronze statue that was designed, I think, in the 50s, and it's kind of handmade bronze. So yeah, they're quite valuable and very beautiful. Yeah. So
that's cool.
It's a nice thing to have at home. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Good. Well, you can put it next to the other one. So, so that's great. Before we get into talking about some of the shows, because I mean, your catalogue's fabulous. But before we get into that, do you want to just give a little bit of background about how you got into composing in the first place?
Yeah, I think you know, everyone's path is different, but similar in a way. I mean, I come from a sort of musically enthusiastic family with, you know, parents singing in choirs, etc. So I was always surrounded by music from an early age. and then, you know, train in piano and flute primarily. And then, of course, as a teenager, at some point, I think there comes a time when you need to rebel against all that classical upbringing that you've got, you know. So I bought this huge synthesizer and I had a band, etc., you know. So, and I was, we were making records and touring. At the same time, though, I was actually always, I think I always wanted to be a film composer. But of course, you know, when you are like 15, 16 years old, you know, nobody's going to ask you to score a film. So I had to make my own films. And they were kind of different things, and they were animations and elaborate adaptation of literary works, and some of it was quite ambitious, but of course, you know, there was always a lot of score in them, you know. Yeah. So, and then I progressed into, I thought I kind of invent the new genre of filmmaking, which is these kind of I wrote these operas that were made for the screen, and then I directed them, and you know, they got bigger and bigger. And Hell for Leather is a longer one, and that was in the end very successful. It premiered at Sundance, won loads of awards, etc. You know, so and at the same time, you know, eventually, you know, I did, when I was quite young, I did end up in London, and I went to film school as well as educating myself further musically. And at film school, everyone basically asked me to score their films, you know, their short films, their student films. And then it carried on and it grew from there, and got the short films became longer and longer, and until I got my first gig, you know, for doing a orchestral feature film score. And only later, really, I ended up in, you know, television, or, you know, doing Netflix and that sort of stuff.
That's interesting, though. I mean, because quite often you don't get composers that have got a sort of that much of a background in sort of film, you know, creating film themselves. They're sort of maybe musical background, but don't necessarily haven't got experience directing or haven't gone to a film school. They've gone to kind of composing courses and that sort of stuff. So do you think that helps you with your composing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't think it will hurt.
No.
I mean, conversely, you know, the other way around, this is very common. So I have a lot of directors who then, you know, they come to my studio here. Actually, they're all bass players for some reason. I don't know why. There are a lot of directors who also play bass. So, but I also, you know, in the end, I think filmmaking and music composition, they're not so dissimilar. You know, it's a very much about finding to tell a story that is beyond just using words. And maybe, you know, sometimes there is a sort of emotional undercurrent that you need to get across. And, you know, filmmaking actually works. You know, a lot of the decisions are similar. And I don't think that it is so different, because it's very much about storytelling.
Yeah. Speaking of storytelling, I mean, Requiem, which is the thing you won the award for most recently, that was a BBC series, and it's now on Netflix. So it's Netflix sort of worldwide, and it's now Netflix over here. I did check, it's no longer on the iPlayer. So if you want to see it, it's on Netflix. Yeah. That's kind of an interesting story. It's very much what I would call a very classic sort of BBC kind of dark drama feel to it. But you've got the interesting side of the fact that the lead character is a cellist. Did that sort of automatically influence you towards using strings and cello in the music?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first, coming back to the Netflix, I mean, Requiem is a Netflix series. So it was in conjunction. So it was always right. Netflix were in there right from the start.
Yes.
And they were, you know, they're co-producers, and we kind of had to satisfy their needs as well as BBC's needs. And so the main character is a concert, you know, an accomplished concert cellist who, you know, it opens with her kind of playing the Royal Festival Hall, etc. And of course, you know, this is a kind of dream for a composer, because, you know, there is actually a reason for music to be in the show, and the reason for maybe more involved type of music to be in the show. And that gives you a fantastic springboard for the score, because sometimes I think you do a score and you don't quite know how to sort of impose some music onto a story, and that early on in a show, that can be quite tricky, you know, because there needs to be, in a way, a reason for this music to play. You know, it isn't just there out of nothing. So, and Requiem being a musical central character, you know, that was great. And also, you know, it gave total justification for there to be some quite virtuoso and involved cello parts, you know. So, and we did have two, you know, fantastic, very different cellists who then I recorded both of those, and they kind of amalgamated into the central characters playing. So it was a sort of manufactured composite persona, which was interesting.
Were you writing and sort of organizing the playing of the character on screen in terms of the music, as well as composing all the music for the show as well?
Well, a little bit. Obviously, you know, Lydia Wilson, she had to, you know, learn how to pretend to play the cello. And I think she did really quite well, because I'm sure it's not easy, you know. So, or I know it's not easy to even mime, you know. So, and then I had some say in the repertoire that was chosen for her to play. And I was keen to make it, you know, maybe a more adventurous, less expected repertoire, you know, because like these days, whenever you have something cello on television or on radio, it means they always play the same piece. It's Bach G major suite. And it seems like for a lot of people is like that, as if that's the only piece of cello that exists. So I didn't want that in there. So I had some Philip Glass, some kind of very involved piece by Kodály, Hungarian composer, a more kind of modernist repertoire. But then, of course, sometimes she may be on screen and then she plays, you know, one of those pieces, but then it kind of merges into score. So then that is also where it becomes incredibly technically very complicated, because this has to be written before and they have to film that, etc. So, but that's kind of the fun and exciting bit. So, yes, so some of that had to be kind of written before, you know, so because the story is that she gets sort of like haunted by this melody that comes back. So it's as if some external forces are forcing her to play this melody on the cello as well. So that's where these kind of merging situations happen.
What was your most interesting experience creating score for Requiem?
There is a lot of kind of audio, that the audio is quite important in the story. Like, for example, the main characters, you know, they end up in this mansion in Wales, and then they go down to the basement and they find these old tapes, like that are maybe 15, 20 years old, and they contain this kind of very strange kind of singing, or you don't actually really know what it is, you know. So to create, that's exciting, because you are actually creating something that's very much part of the on-screen, the diegetic part of the story.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, your list of work, as well as Requiem, is quite impressive. You've got things like Baptiste, The Missing, Ripper Street, which was a fabulous series. The Missing, I thought was quite interesting. I was watching some things online. You talked about the creation of that sort of tinnitus sound,
right?
Using glasses, which I thought was brilliant, because I mean that works so well. Were there any sort of other strange instruments you've either used on Requiem or the more sound designy sort of stuff where you've picked something up like a dustbin lid and thought, oh, this will work? You know, I love it when composers just find things that sort of think, oh, that's got an interesting sound to it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, you do this all the time. I mean, like I'm here at the studio and I have some instruments hanging here. I have like a viola. I can't play viola, but I have a viola, because you can make all sorts of other sounds with it, you know, so you can hit it and you can stroke the bow across it in a kind of unfriendly manner. And so, of course, yes, what we do on Requiem, you know, we used a lot of, you know, Natasha Khan did some singing, then we would mess with those vocals, of course, you know, some of it, a lot of those kind of deep horror type drones are actually simply her vocal, but slowed down or using some kind of other means of pitch shifting. And then, for example, on The Widow, which is this, you know, series that I did for Amazon that that's set in Africa, you sometimes want a sort of almost a kind of ethnic color in there. So we have just sometimes used like even simple instruments like ukulele, but you know, the way you play them and maybe dampen them more so they sort of sound maybe as if they come from Africa. And, you know, it's so you, I often I think it's kind of exciting to you, you know, to actually make your own samples and just even we are using, or like in Requiem, we were instead of using a bass drum, you know, for a, sometimes there is a sort of pretty much a kind of four on the floor kind of, or a three on the floor pulse on there. But that's just Natasha stamping her foot on the floor here, you know, because it, there is a kind of intensity to it that maybe you don't really get from a bass drum. So, and I think it's generally really important, you know, to actually have some unique sounds, because I think the audience will find, will connect those sounds with the story much better if they're unique and they haven't heard them before.
I mean, you talk about using unique sounds and creating your own samples. What do you use sample libraries that much, or do you is it sort of a case of recording absolutely everything, or at least as much as you can get away with?
No, I mean, also, of course, I do use sample libraries because, you know, you need to do mock-ups because, you know, for the producers, I mean, as in, you know, you need to, if you're recording an orchestra or a string section later on, you need to play a kind of electronically mocked up version to the producers and the director. So, of course, for that, you need to samples, and then, you know, for a lot of like piano stuff I use samples, and then, you know, sometimes I like just messing about with samples as well. You know, there's like some samples I use a zither sample that I like, but I like it when it's two octaves down and things like that.
Yeah, I love finding either weird instruments or how, you know, the people are you're sort of playing around with maybe some established stuff to get the unique sound is really nice.
Yeah,
there is another series which you worked on, which I loved and amazingly is now about 10 years old, which is Primeval.
Yeah,
how was it coming up with music for that show? Because I mean, you know, you've done quite a lot of these sort of dark dramas more recently, and then Primeval is kind of this sci-fi thing about like dinosaurs coming through time portals. And how is it working on a show like that, which is sort of quite far detached from the stuff that you're doing these days?
Well, I mean, you know, it's funny you say it's sort of detached from what I'm doing now, but because, you know, you go through different phases in your career, because that's sometimes, you know, like when I was doing Primeval 3-4 years earlier, I started doing Miss Marple, you know, which is a which can be pretty dark as well, but there is a sort of, you know, nice English pastoral side to it as well. And before that, I was doing a lot of indie film comedy stuff. So I think, you know, sometimes people perceive you in one way and then, but you actually doing a lot of different stuff. So, Primeval, I mean, I came on board because I had worked with the producers before on two other shows. And what I liked about it was that the producer at the time, you know, he just wanted really a kind of, you know, for example, the title theme, you know, he wanted it like really energetic and you know, as if you're kind of imagining sort of big hordes of dinosaurs running down and screaming and, you know, to have that big and epic energy behind it. That was the fun part. It was not an easy show to score because there's a lot of action, and at that time, you know, it's sort of that also special effects, I guess, weren't, you know, so far advanced then, or it wasn't so quick, so I was often working to more kind of basic version, you know, wireframe versions of those scenes, but they had to be scored very, very tightly because otherwise those action scenes would fall flat a bit, you know. So it was a lot of intricate work on Primeval.
Yeah, that must have been sort of actors playing to green screen with like tennis balls on the end when you're trying to write score to it. Yeah,
exactly. It was like that. But I mean, it was a kind of mix of some of it was quite genuinely scary, and then some of it was quite sort of, you know, had a youthful fun to it. And you know, in the first 2.5 series, you know, I thought who was great was Douglas Henshall, who really gave the story a kind of urgency, you know, and he was so good at delivering these kind of strange and very technical lines about, you know, because he played a scientist, and so he gave it that sort of gravitas, and everything I did was a little bit based around his character because it helped me to give it a kind of gravitas.
Yeah, I can see that. He was fabulous in that. I really liked that show. I thought it was wonderful fun. And you don't get those sort of, you don't get that many sci-fi things made in the UK these days. So, you know.
No, it's true. We should definitely do more.
Yeah, we really should.
I did do another one though.
Which one was that?
The City and the City.
Oh, of course, yes, The City and the City.
That was more a kind of near future parallel universe. It was kind of, essentially, it was science fiction,
Yes, that is true. That is true. What are you doing next? Have you got anything that you can talk about coming up?
Yeah, I'm doing a Netflix series that's set in Southeast Asia in the mid-70s. So it'll be exciting. I'll be traveling out to Bangkok this summer. I'll be recording some of it there. And also, you know, the production is based there, I mean, for the shoot. So, you know, post-production, we'll be back in London again. But this is working again with Tom Shankland, who I've worked with in the past a few times. He was the lead director on the first two series on Ripper Street, director of first series of The Missing, etc. So I like being near him when he shoots because we can already try some stuff against picture, and it's a kind of collaborative process like we did on The Missing, for example, as well. So, and on The City and the City as well. So, so I'm looking forward to that. I'm just getting, starting with some themes for that at the moment.
You're hunting for new instruments as well, when you're out there looking for sounds.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think it will have to sort of sound particularly Asian, you know, it's not really sort of set in the Asian community, but it's, there will definitely be a kind of mid-70s influence in there.
Oh, that'll be really fun to do. Awesome.
Yeah.
The last two questions that we always ask everybody, so they're always the same. First question is, what TV shows are you watching at the moment?
Chernobyl.
I hear everybody tells me that's fabulous, and I'm saving it like when I'm on holiday
so I can binge my way through it because it's not all out yet. But it's a good score as well by this Icelandic cellist, I think, but also it's exciting because it's an event, you know, that when you were young it happened, and now to kind of see it in a different light. So, but it's brilliantly made as well. It's a different kind of storytelling.
Yeah. Everybody tells me that's fabulous. So I am looking forward to getting to that. And lastly, if you had the opportunity to work on any TV show, either past, present or future, which show would it be?
Well, you know, something I love, you know, something like Handmaid's Tale. I think that kind of genre, you know, which I like a lot, these kind of parallel universe or dystopian or utopian as well.
Awesome. That'd be good. Well, I'm sure that something will come up. Well, there is Amazon are making a Utopia remake of the Channel 4 series. So, you know, maybe that's something you could look at.
Are they now?
Okay. Yes.
There was talk about a film or something or Netflix or I can't remember who. So that's happening with Amazon now.
Well, yes.
I hope they're getting Cristobal Tapia de Ver to score it, because I think I thought that was a fantastic score for Utopia. So I'd be missing that score if it wasn't there. So
yeah, it's going to be interesting. It's Gillian Flynn, who wrote Gone Girl, is going to be the writer of it.
Okay.
So we'll have to wait and see, but it is shaping up to look like quite an interesting series. But I don't know whether they've got a composer. So
Well, you know, Cristobal should do it.
So. Yeah. Awesome. Well, it's been lovely chatting with you, and I look forward to seeing your new series when that comes out. And congratulations once again on the award. That's Fabulous. Hopefully we can have you back on again at some point in the future.
Brilliant. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Bye. So that was the interview with Dominic. Hope you really enjoyed that. If you want to catch up with Requiem, you can find it on Netflix, because as he said, it is a Netflix and BBC co-production. So it is on Netflix if you want to go and catch that now. Here's some highlights for next week on TV. So highlights for next week on TV. We have Warrior Season 1. That is coming to Sky One on the 25th of June at 9 p.m. This is a Cinemax martial arts drama. Follows a martial arts prodigy who emigrates to San Francisco from China to become hatchet man for the most powerful Tong organization in Chinatown. Interestingly, it's based on an original concept by Bruce Lee, but it's taken until now for somebody to actually make it into a TV show.
It's a good classic martial arts plot in inverted commas, that, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. So Cold Warrior, it seems to have gone down fairly well in the US. So that's 25th of June, that's coming, and that's at 9 p.m. on Sky One. How to Get Away with Murder Season 5 finally arrives on Sky Witness. It's been a long wait for that, and we've had a lot of people asking about that. So that returns for its fifth season. That's on the 26th of June at 9 p.m. Bellevue, which is Canadian crime drama starring Anna Paquin. This is one of the things I was mentioning earlier. It comes to MyFi, which is a streaming service. They've got a couple of other dramas that they're shoving out on this as well, or have already shoved out on this. 28th of June, that's landing. Yeah, they seem to be picking up these smaller crime dramas that are either sort of one or two season shows, and you know, things like stuff from Canada and stuff, and they're shoving them out on MyFi. So weirdly, MyFi seems to have a better output than Channel 5 at this point. So 28th of June, and it's called Bellevue, that one. Private Eyes, which is the procedural Canadian PI drama that's starring Jason Priestley, that's 1st of July on Universal TV. That's at 8 p.m. that arrives. The Rook, for those of you with Virgin Media, I think it's actually going out on the Virgin High Def channel as well, but it's going out on Virgin On Demand 1st of July for that. That is an adaptation of Daniel O'Malley's supernatural novel about a young woman pursued by shadowy paranormal adversaries while grappling with extraordinary abilities of her own, exclusively to Virgin at the moment. Sorry, everybody else. Waco, the miniseries that starred Michael Shannon and Taylor Kitsch, that is coming to Alibi on the 1st of July at 9 p.m. We've interviewed a few people involved with Waco, and looks kind of interesting, that one. So obviously about the events of the Waco siege in 1993. That's only a miniseries, but great cast, and I think could very well be worth watching. 1st of July at 9 p.m. for that. Nightfall Season 2 comes to History on the 2nd of July at 9 p.m. Drama series that follows the Knights Templar, starring Tom Cullen with added Mark Hamill for the second season, which is never a bad thing. I enjoyed the first season of that. I'm looking forward to watching the second season, so worth going to watch. And Crashing Season 3 and the final season of Crashing is coming to Sky Atlantic on the 2nd of July at 10 past 10. That's the Judd Apatow series about a comedian that ends up couch surfing after his marriage falls apart. So third and final season of that on Sky Atlantic, 2nd of July at 10 past 10. And that's everything for next week, unless you've got anything else you want to mention?
No, I've just binge watching my way through iZombie at the moment.
Yes.
So I'm quite merry and happy because that is going from strength to strength still, and catching up on everything I've missed from having 5 weeks of no TV.
Yes.
So, yeah, we have Happy Season 2 and the rest of iZombie. I need to finish Osmosis as well, the French science fiction series.
Yes.
On Netflix. Yeah, there's so much good stuff.
There is a lot of good TV around at the moment. We're really not sure some things to watch.
Spoilt for choice, especially when there's things that are outside my normal area that people are highly recommending, like Chernobyl and things. I need more TV hours than I have time for, which is a pretty good place to be.
Yeah, I mean, over the next month, we've got Stranger Things Season 3 coming up. You've got the third and final season of Legion coming up. Outpost returns for a second season. Elementary
final
is
back. Season of Killjoys is coming up too.
Yeah, final season of Killjoys. Final season of Elementary. There's Orange is the New Black is back. And you've got The Boys coming at the end of July as well, which is the adaptation of the Garth Ennis comic book from Eric Kripke, the amazing creator of Supernatural.
Good Omens.
Yeah, Good Omens, if you've not watched that, obviously we did the premiere for that, but if you've not watched Good Omens, it's brilliant, and unfortunately cancelled by Netflix. If you've seen any of the internet stuff.
And now I know that before having even watched the first episode. Thanks.
No,
but it's going to be brilliant. David Tennant can't help it.
There was a whole thing going around the internet. Basically, there was a group of the so-called Christians in the US that are demanding the cancellation of Good Omens, even though A, it is only a one season show because it's based off a book, so it was never going to be more than a mini series. And two, they demanded the cancellation from Netflix, and it's not on Netflix, it's on Amazon Prime. So failed on all counts there, but it did have a hilarious exchange between Netflix going, okay, we promise not to make any more Good Omens, to which Amazon Prime responded, well, okay, we'll cancel Stranger Things if you cancel Good Omens. So yes,
it sort of reminds me of when everyone was texting NASA to go and help out Tony Stark before yes. Endgame, and they were replying. It's always good when there's people can see the funny side of things as well. Sad people wanted to cancel it, but hopefully once they realised the error, it became a bit more jovial.
Yes, yeah. So yes, I mean, Good Omens. I don't think he's ever going to come back for another season because it was only ever designed to be a miniseries. There's that. I mean, I would love it if they did make more of it, but yeah, the petition that went round asked Netflix to cancel it, and it's not a Netflix show, it's an Amazon Prime show. So yeah.
Well, if they have covered the whole of the book in the first yes. season, that's sort of, having read the book, that makes sense.
Yes
I'm not sure how you would
exactly.
Hopefully it will open the floodgates for some more books to get adapted. It'd be nice to see gaming or Discworld stuff going up.
Yeah, I would like to see Gaiman maybe do some more of Pratchett stuff. I mean, I know he doesn't have the direct connection to it, but I would like to see them do a bit more of it. I know Sky have done some of them, but I would like to see them do a little bit more, maybe use some of the same cast but in different roles, that sort of stuff. That would be great. It would be good if you could have a little group of kind of Pratchett players. You know how they do with things like American Horror, where it's the same cast in different roles, and maybe you do something like that moving forward. But I would love to see them adapt more as miniseries. It'd be fabulous. So that's everything for this week. You can find Bex on...
You can find me slightly less jet lagged than I was before, putting up videos about geek stuff, reviews, interviews, and some videos of the geeky stuff over in Japan up on my YouTube channel, which is Trista Bytes, spelt like computer byte because I thought I was funny. I'm also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and sometimes up on the geektown.co.uk website as well.
Yes, and obviously for us, you can find us on geektown.co.uk throughout the week and see all the latest air data information and TV news. If you want to get in touch with your questions and comments, email us on podcast@geektown.co.uk, leave a message on the website post, find us at Geektown on Twitter, on Facebook at facebook.com/geektown, on YouTube at youtube.com/geektown, and on Instagram @geektownuk. That is everything. We shall see you next week. Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.